Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Good morning and welcome to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden and I am here with our co-host Jeff Patino. And we are looking forward to a very exciting show today. But first, a little bit about us. Jeff and I work at the Binary Research Institute in Newport Beach, California. And it's there that we investigate megalithic structures and the possibility that the ancients knew a lot more than we currently give them credit for. Specifically, we believe that our solar system might be gravitationally bound to another star, and that our motion around that other star could indirectly be the result of the rise and fall of the ages that so many ancient cultures seem to speak about. And in fact, over 30 ancient cultures talked about this, according to Giorgio de Santayana, the former professor of the history of science at MIT. And so it is here where we study much of the mythology and the structures and just the folklore and science related to this phenomena. And as most of you know, each week we introduce different guests that talk on some aspect of this, and we have a very exciting guest today that Jeff Patino will be introducing.
Yes, we do. And hi, once again, I'm Jeff Patino, and thanks again for joining us. If at any point you'd like more information about the topics we're discussing on the show, please feel free to visit our website at www.loststarbook.com. Today, our guest is John Burke. He's the co-author of a really great book, Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty. And John's an international businessman and an inventor with a university background in physics from SUNY Stony Brook. He founded Proceed Technologies and as the CEO has demonstrated in-field trials at organizations and universities around the world how artificial versions of electromagnetic energies can enhance crop yields. He is a co-patent holder for molecular impulse response seed enhancement technology, and his work has appeared on Fox Networks, Discovery Channel, History Channel, and 2020.
I read John's book, Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty, about a year ago, and it just blew me away because John is a scientist by background, but interested in some very esoteric things. He actually visited, I believe it was more than 80 different megalithic sites, from Mayan sites to Stonehenge and Karnak and many others around the world. And unlike your average tourist that goes and visits these sites, John would take some scientific equipment with him, an electrostatic voltmeter and a magnetometer, and he'll get into the specifics of that. But he was able to determine that many of these sites display anomalous electrostatic or electromagnetic fields. And not only that, but that if he takes seeds to many of these sites, that the seeds are stressed in such a way that the seeds will actually then propagate faster, or you'll get higher crop yields from those seeds. And it's just an astounding bit of really hard science.
Yeah, and I think one of the really, really interesting things is that this is something the ancients may have known, and that it's something that we are just rediscovering today, that these electromagnetic influences can, in fact, enhance crop yields and really, really create a tangible effect.
Mm-hmm. Just quickly, the book has been reviewed by a couple of very astute friends. One is Robert Schock. Robert is a professor of geology over at Boston University, and he had this to say. He said, "The thesis put forth by John Burke and Kaj Halberg in Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty is utterly fascinating. These ideas provide a new and groundbreaking approach to understanding the mysteries of ancient megalithic structures." And indeed they do, and so that is what we'll be talking about here in just a few moments with John Burke.
And just a quick note, John will also be presenting at the upcoming CPAC 2006 conference at UCI this coming October.
Yes, along with Robert Schock, who I just mentioned, John Anthony West, Graham Hancock.
Jeff Marcy,
he's an astronomer from UC Berkeley. He's found more planets around other stars than anybody else on the planet today. And so if you want more information on that, the website is
cpaconline.com. And you can find out all about all the presenters there and even register for the conference right online.
So you are listening to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cretinen with
Jeff Pitino, and we will be right back.
Expanding your mind. HealthyLife.net.
Hi, and welcome back. You're listening to The Cosmic Influence. I'm Jeff Pitino with our host, Walter Cruttenden, and today our guest is John Burke, co-author of Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty. So, John, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us, how exactly did you get involved in the work that you do, mainly the seed technology, and then even more so, how did you get involved in looking into ancient megaliths and what their effects might be?
Yeah, well, I would have only had half as much to say about the ancient megaliths if I had not already been involved in the seed technology. That was primarily developed by a biophysicist who specializes in the electrophysiology of plants, and he literally stumbled on this effect during some work that he was doing, and then knuckled down and spent a couple of years with trial and error until he could produce some equipment that could duplicate that effect, which at the time was simply accelerated germination. But then I ended up, another accident, being in England with the right instruments, and the farmer who owned the B&B where I was staying said, "You ought to take those instruments up to Avebury Henge and measure those stones. You'd get some readings on those stones." And I really didn't believe I would, but one day when things were slow, I did, and much to my surprise, I stumbled into something that kept me working 5 weeks on that particular location in 1993, and then got me interested to see whether other locations also had these peculiar arrangements of the electromagnetic energy that was available.
So then just to back up to tell our listeners, you know, exactly what were you doing before looking at the first megalithic structures in terms of these instruments and seeds?
Well, at the time I got interested in this phenomenon called crop circles, which was very much in the news at the time, and mm-hmm. they all seemed to be happening over in England, and you know, that struck me as odd if these were a natural phenomenon. And I was studying at the time a certain type of energy form called a scroll wave, and these really looked like, at first, these simple circles looked like they might be a form of scroll wave, and I got wondering why in a particular area. My best friend is a geologist who suggested it would be fun to know what kind of geology underlies that area. So I went over with the magnetometer, the electrostatic voltmeter, and the instruments to measure telluric or electric ground current. And was knocking around the same, it was the same place as most of the large megalithic monuments, such as Stonehenge, Avebury Henge, which is actually vastly larger and the predecessor to Stonehenge, and then half a mile from there, Silbury Hill, which is the oldest, largest man-made mound in Europe, and at 3000 BC, one of the oldest as well. And started to find, you know, looking around the landscape, started to find that these particular spots were very unique, very different from the other locations, in the way the natural daily electromagnetic fluctuations were happening. Every morning on this planet, around dawn, the Earth's magnetic field surges. It dies away at night, comes back again in the daytime.
And that's just because the Earth is turning towards the sun?
Exactly, yes. And it's all about the solar wind impacting the geomagnetic field lines that increases the strength of them. So you have this rise that's fastest in the hours around dawn, but it's pretty mild in the vast majority of places on the planet, but not in these locations that I just mentioned. And as I did more and more research over the years, found that there's a certain type of geology which will actually magnify these types of fluctuations several fold. And what that means is that these magnetic fluctuations are generating electric or telluric ground current. And then I began to look in that light again at these structures and see that they were actually built, designed and built in a perfect way to further concentrate those kinds of energies.
And so how exactly are you going about this? You're taking your equipment at what time to what location on the mound and et cetera?
Well, the best is about 2-3 hours before dawn, and somewhere around sunrise the effects starts to weaken pretty rapidly. So it's unfortunate working hours. But the other question is, you really want to know what's happening on the top and the bottom of the mound at the same time, and without multiple instruments, you do a lot of running up and down. I've gotten a lot of legwork on pyramids and mounds and other things, and you just keep moving and catch what you can and then come back. In the case of Silbury Hill, precisely what we did was to spend 1 week, twice a day, each day, measuring the geomagnetic field strength at the top of the hill and the bottom of the hill, as well as the ground current between those two spots. And then on one particular day, worked all the way around the hill, measuring the ground current from the bottom to the top. And at the time, we didn't know what to expect, and we weren't that excited by the results we got. You know, it wasn't pushing a meter off the scale or anything like that. But when I began to realize how henges, the actual ditch of a henge, will concentrate these ground currents at these intact bridges that are left where the ditch did not go through, where the ground is left intact, sure enough, we had taken a measurement that showed that dramatically, that the ground current over that bridge, if you will, that gap in the ditch, was about triple what it was anywhere along the ditch, and that the geomagnetic readings rose and fell according to a known proportion with the telluric ground current. It's known that for every 100 units of geomagnetic field change, you get 100 millivolts per kilometer change in ground current. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but when you get involved with this seed effect, they don't require very strong currents either. They work with very mild energies, if you will.
Well, then tell us about the seed effect.
Well, that was the frame of mind I was lucky enough to be in, really, at that time, and began thinking of it. And particularly when I reviewed the chronology of these sites and found that they were built at a time of famine in a place that was suffering soil exhaustion. And yet they spent 14 million man hours building a hill like this. Sounds like a recipe for suicide, you know, but and yet wealth poured into the area after they were finished, and there was no known link there. But the same similar types of energies to what we were measuring is used in our business using high-tech, you know, electronic equipment to expose all types of agricultural seeds to a gentle electron shower. And that actually puts a temporary stress on the seed, which increases free radical production.
Is this a common process, John? If I'm a farmer up here in Fresno Valley, would I buy seed that has been exposed to a charge like this?
Yeah, you can, and some people do. It's more dramatic. The differences are more dramatic with vegetables than with commodity crops like corn and soybeans.
I see.
But it's particularly productive in improving stress tolerance. So the more stress any one farm has, the more dramatic the differences you see. When the stresses are low, you'll just see higher yields. When the stresses are high, you'll see dramatic visual differences in the plants at a glance.
And are we talking about a very specific type of energy or type of
charge?
Of charge?
Yeah, it's essentially the seed is passed between two metal plates, the bottom one of which has a positive electric charge. The top one is grounded. And so that positively charged bottom plate sucks negatively charged electrons out of the top plate across the airspace in between. And you get this very gentle shower of electrons coming down, and in between is the seeds, and they impact the seeds and generate this biochemical process that takes actually a few weeks to take place with the very slow physiology of a dried seed.
In your book, you had compared the stress on a seed to like the stress on a muscle that you work out.
Yes.
So what exactly is happening to the seed by this subtle energy?
Yeah, when you talk about just what happens to the seed, it sounds exotic, except that it's the exact same things that happens in our own bodies when we run, for example, and one of the reasons we run. It's that under stress, the mitochondria, the little energy factories inside each cell, they'll produce a lot more free radicals than normal when conditions are stressful. But what that does is that spike of free radicals prompts the cell to produce its own natural defenses in the form of a whole slew of different antioxidants, anything from vitamin C and others. And after they've gobbled up the free radicals, now you've got more antioxidants sitting around than when you started. And even more importantly, the cell now has practice, if you will, at responding to these free radical spikes, which was what you're going to get with future stresses. So it works a lot like an inoculation, in a sense. You give someone a shot of a disease in order to stimulate their immune system so that the next time they encounter that disease, the immune system is going to be able to handle it better. And the same thing happens really when we run. The increased breathing involved when we're doing aerobic exercise means that more free radicals are being produced inside these mitochondria. And the same thing happens. Our own cells produce natural antioxidants to combat them. And then in the future, they're better able to handle this situation. And that's one of the ways in which aerobic fitness develops with practice.
That's absolutely fascinating. So then at these, you took the seeds to these different locations around the world. How many locations roughly did you go to?
Several dozen locations, but numerous of the locations had multiple sites within them. So I think something like 68 or so altogether. I have to keep, it keeps changing.
And I understand when you would do this, you would also have a control lot of seed or two that you said you'd kept in the car or kept in the laboratory?
Yeah, we would try to do both. We'd keep one in the lab and one 100 feet minimum outside the megalithic structure where we were placing the seed.
But it's the same batch of seeds that you just split in half or something?
Exactly, like. Yes. And we got the most dramatic effects when I was able to work with a Harvard ethnobotanist who has a network of people keeping some of the ancient seed stocks alive. For example, this Iroquois blue flint corn that we show some dramatic photos of in the book, it's a type that was being grown since 700 AD on the East Coast. At the same time, these rock chambers in the northeastern U.S. were built and being used. And you have that was weak seed. It's not as sophisticated as today's hybrids, etc., and therefore there's more room for improvement. And when we did that, we got double to triple the amount of harvest per acre compared to the controls. And that was with 9 different batches of seeds placed in structures and 17 different controls.
I mean, that is huge.
That's mind-blowing. That's amazing.
I would think that most farmers would be happy, you know, with a 10-15% increase in yield.
They sure are, but that's about what you'd hope for with today's modern seed, with the kind of all the breeding and the selectivity that's been done, particularly in the last few decades. You know, the seed is so much better that now, yeah, we'd maybe improve 15 to 25% depending on the crop. But that's still dramatic when you're talking about a bottom line for a farmer that's measured in the single digits.
Yeah. Sure is.
In how many different countries did you find these megaliths? And is there any one particular region of the world, do you think, that seemed to have a greater concentration of them than others?
Actually, in terms of numbers, the United States has one of the best concentrations, if you will, and that's something I think the average American is not aware of. We think of these megalithic structures as being overseas, something you have to take a plane to, but two-thirds of the American population lives within a few hours' drive of these types of structures. And in fact, we have an entire appendix listing places in the United States, Canada, and some other countries that are open to the public, and we give full, you know, directions and hours of operation, et cetera.
Yeah, I saw it in your book there. I think it's page 81, where you have a map of many of the different sites just in America.
Yes.
And the dots, you know, you almost blacken the page with,
yes,
the number of sites there.
Now, that map was actually made by one of the first archaeological explorers of Indian mounds in this country almost 100 years ago. So a lot of those dots got erased by farmers wanting to have a nice extended flat field. But, you know, hundreds of them are still available and out there and open to the public.
Good. Well, we want to go see some. But first, we have to take a break. You are listening to Cosmic Influence with our special guest today, John Burke, and we will be right back.
If you are interested in the topics discussed on today's show, you'll want to see Walter Crittenden's award-winning film, The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones. Why do civilizations fall and rise again? What did the ancients say about the cycle of the ages? The Great Year explores the possibility that the rise and fall of human culture might be related to our sun's motion around a companion star. Find out more about the celestial mechanics that bring higher ages of enlightenment and learn where we are today in this grand cycle of time. It's a message of hope and inspiration, and answers many questions about the greatest enigmas of human history. Order the DVD today at thegreatyear.com. That's www.thegreatyear.com. www.thegreatyear.com.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Crittenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
For all your live or pre-recorded webcasting needs, come to earthchannel.com. Get your web-based message out to a select group or the whole world. It's easy. A pioneer in webcasting, earthchannel.com provides the best products and services to big corporations and government users. And now, this same technology is available to you. They have the best earthcast encoders, servers, and products to meet your technical needs. But wait, don't want to mess with technical stress? No problem. They'll do it for you. earthchannel.com is your answer. You can use webcasting for lots of things, like advertising, marketing, customer support, training, and don't forget, web radio and TV. In fact, you're listening to a live Earthcast right now, so come to earthchannel.com. Actualize your audio or video webcasting needs today. You can't beat the friendly service or the price. Call earthchannel.com at 800-849-8978. That's 800-849-8978.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cruttenden with co-host Jeff Pitino, and we are with our special guest today, John Burke, the author of Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty.
And just a quick note, if at any point you'd like more information on the show or our discussions here, please visit our website at www.loststarbook.com.
And let's also give your website, John. What is it?
Well, actually, I encourage people to, the best place to start is simply to log on to Amazon.com and search the name of the book, Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty, because they have these search the book features, so you can read sample chapters, table of context, index, and even search for terms or particular things that you are interested in.
Perfect. Yeah. Speaking of searches, I'm wondering about the ancient cultures and why they would have thought to have brought seed to these sites in the first place. And yet I saw in your book that you mentioned that there's some myth and folklore about certain cultures would bring their seed to be blessed.
Yeah, and in fact, to give you one example from four different continents, if you will, in Zimbabwe in Africa, which I did not get a chance to investigate, I have seen, however, that you can bring your and it looks just like a good megalithic structure. My suspicions are that it would work similar to the way these others do. But at any rate, even today, you can bring your seed to a shaman there who will bless your seed in return for 10% of your seed. Suggesting, a profit possibility and profit motive here, because the history of these megaliths is that they're built at a time of difficulty when there's soil exhaustion and food shortages, and after completion, the people in the area grow rich. Moving to England, in the henges, the technical definition of a henge is really a C-shaped ditch, and they leave one section of the earth intact, which is the gap in the sea, so to speak. And that's because that will concentrate these ground currents. And then the builders dug these shallow clay-lined pits that they predominantly placed right at those spots, the gaps where the energy would be strongest. And there are numerous henges in England where they have found people brought carefully cleaned wheat seed to these structures and placed them in those pits. So there was something going on involving that. And then in the U.S., by the time the Europeans got here, most of the mounds were no longer being used by the Indians. In fact, they had even forgotten who built them or what they were used for. But the one exception was the Natchez tribe down in around Louisiana, and a Jesuit missionary around 1730 or so wrote home to his superior saying that no farmer in this area would dream of planting his seed without first bringing it to the top of the mounds for quote-unquote, certain blessings. And then finally, in Tikal, Guatemala, which was the first and oldest city of the Mayans, people still do bring their seeds to the top of the pyramids today. We found direct evidence of that ourselves while we were there. But the irony is that much of the knowledge survived, but another part of the knowledge was lost in that they bring them to the pyramids that are not electrically active. And the one that we found that produced dramatic effects on seed in Tikal, which is the oldest pyramid there, they're not bringing it to. They're going to the fancier-looking later ones. I think it's a fine example of a certain amount of preserved knowledge combined with other key lost knowledge.
Right. Yeah, I was really amazed with that fact that because it fit with our theory that cultures really were more advanced in the very distant past, and then we lost some of that knowledge. So you're saying that, as I recall, some of the newer sites, say the newest Mayan pyramids, don't have this effect, whereas virtually all the older ones do?
I can't say virtually all the older ones, just of the few that we were able to measure. The very first pyramid ever built by the Mayans, the Lost World Pyramid it's called, which is their cultural link with the Olmec, who were also practicing mound and pyramid building and seemingly benefiting from it. That one has fantastic energy, and you start picking it up the moment you step off the jungle trail onto the mini plateau on which the pyramid is sited. So it's coming from the ground, all around the pyramid. You can measure that. By comparison, the most famous ones, the Kings and Queens pyramids, which were built 1,300 years later as a political monument to a king who had freed the Mayans from subjugation by another tribe, those were simply fancier structures put on electrically dead ground and produced no particular charges or fluctuations or any effect on the seed.
So presumably in those 1,300 years, they'd lost the ability somehow, some way to detect.
Yeah, at a minimum, apparently for the century before those last pyramids were built, they had been subjugated by another tribe, and my guess is that that might have been the time at which this orally passed knowledge, secret knowledge most likely, was lost.
With a lot of these structures around the world, both the henges and the megalithic structures here in the Americas, is there a common date of construction or a date range of construction, or does it really vary?
No, it ranges from over 6,000 years.
Many of these sites, I understand, it's not the structure itself, but it's actually something under the ground that the site is marking. Is that what we feel?
They're placed on sites where these electromagnetic fluctuations, these natural fluctuations, are strongest. And so that's why they site them there. And then they design and build them in such a way that it further concentrates the energy. The structures are known technically as conductivity discontinuities, which sounds quite technical, but all it means is it's the border between where one area of ground that conducts electrical ground current well meets another area of ground that does not conduct electrical ground current as well. And what's interesting is the two biggest conductivity discontinuities in the United States are in Petroglyph National Monument in New Mexico and in the Black Hills of South Dakota, and both of those were active Vision Quest sites.
Ah.
So it looks like pre-agricultural peoples were also tapping into this energy, but for Vision Quests.
Good. Well, we will want to talk to you then about some of the other reasons these sites might have been used. First, we're going to let people again know what these websites are and then take a short break.
Yeah, if you'd like more information on the show, please visit us at www.loftstarbook.com. And John's book, Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty, is available readily on Amazon.com.
And you're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Cruttenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
What does HealthyLife.net and Amazon.com have in common? Well, they're both available on the Internet. They both give great value. But most important, most of our positive program hosts and guests are accomplished authors. And their books are available from, you got it, Amazon.com. Now, it even gets better than that. Because when you're listening on air to a HealthyLife.net host or guest, you can go directly to Amazon.com and you can order your book while you're still listening to your favorite HealthyLife.net program. So when you hear an author you like, go to the homepage of HealthyLife.net and click on Amazon.com.
If you are interested in the topics discussed on today's show, you'll want to see Walter Cruttenden's award-winning film, The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones. Why do civilizations fall and rise again? What did the ancients say about the cycle of the ages? The Great Year explores the possibility that the rise and fall of human culture might be related to our sun's motion around a companion star. Find out more about the celestial mechanics that bring higher ages of enlightenment and learn where we are today in this grand cycle of time. It's a message of hope and inspiration and answers many questions about the greatest enigmas of human history. Order the DVD today at thegreatyear.com. That's www.thegreatyear.com. www.thegreatyear.com. thegreatyear.com.
Byregion.net is the largest healing arts directory on the web. Our visitors are looking for holistic practitioners, schools, events, healing services, and products. Are you in healing arts? Become a member of Byregion.net and get the best advertising values. You can increase your client base and your traffic. If you have a website, we can bring you more traffic. Want a website? Get a beautiful web display for only $4 a month. Become a member now. Mention HealthyLife.net and get 6 months free. Visit www.byregion.net or call 828-232-0016.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Krutnin with co-host Jeff Pitino, and we are listening today or talking with John Burke, the author of Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty. And John, right before we went on the last break there, you were mentioning vision quests, that some of these sites had purposes beyond just enhancing the quality of seed. What other purposes were they used for?
Well, in pre-agricultural peoples, such as hunter-gatherer Native American tribes, we've seen that shamans were selecting the same type of geologies in order to conduct vision quests. I had mentioned conductivity discontinuities and how the biggest ones are in places where it looks like the most recorded vision quest activity lies as well. And in one particular spot in South Dakota on the Sioux Indian Reservation, remember the Sioux were buffalo hunters primarily, they were not farmers. But there's a school of vision quests that's been going on, it looks like, unbroken since Crazy Horse's era. And Crazy Horse literally was being taken to these same spots that are in a park today that is closed to whites after dark because it's still an active religious site for Native Americans. But the Butte is it's a volcanic plug. It's actually a geological twin of Devil's Tower. And it means it's got lots of metals in the rock beneath the soil, and it means it's got lots of magnetic anomalies scattered over the hill. And as we went up the trail measuring these things, every single magnetic anomaly that we found was decorated with these brightly colored cotton cloths that were blowing in the wind. And up at the top, there were this sort of razor top to this narrow butte, had five different anomalies on it. Four of them had small pits dug and a stone wall built around them, just enough for a person to sit in. And the fifth one, which was the strongest one up there, and had a sleeping bag stashed in a tree nearby, didn't have a pit dug, but it had this square area about 5 feet by 5 feet marked off with a system of cotton flags of different colors and arranged very, at the different cardinal points in this square. And we sensed it was important enough that we photographed and documented it very thoroughly about which direction the black flag was pointing at, et cetera, et cetera. And then later on, stumbled into a book detailing a vision quest from 1965 where a Sioux who was seeking help to kick his alcoholism, went to his shaman and asked for a vision quest. And the guy took him to one of these type buttes, placed him on that spot, and around the hours before dawn, just when these fluctuations would be greatest, he had a series of just mind-blowing visions and never had another drink in his life. No drugs, no fasting, just the electromagnetic energies produced an extremely powerful vision quest. And it turns out that this whole series of flags, identical in color and location, was developed by Crazy Horse's spiritual mentor and childhood friend. And it's obviously been passed down as a tradition that's still followed in that kind of detail. The thing to bear in mind is what I said before about these magnetic fluctuations. They'll be stronger on a magnetic anomaly than elsewhere. And the key thing as far as vision quest goes is that any fluctuation in a magnetic field will generate an electrical current in anything there that is capable of conducting electricity, which includes the ground for these megalithic structures. But obviously, you know, the brain, the human brain, is one terrific conductor of electricity. So you're setting off these little currents inside the head with these magnetic fluctuations. And Michael Persinger, a Canadian neuroscientist, he's done work replicating this effect in the lab for a couple of decades now. And what was interesting was that when he and I compared notes, our findings matched even quantitatively. In other words, the degree of magnetic fluctuation per hour that we were finding on these kind of sites matched what he and his colleagues have found in the lab is the minimum required to produce a vision.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I think at CPAC coming up in October, I know you and Graham will have some interesting conversations because he's been doing a lot of research on vision quests. In fact, his latest book, Supernatural, is specifically about that.
Yes, I'm very much looking forward to that.
Now, also, in our book, Lost Star of Myth and Time, we had touched on that subject and trying to understand what it was about the binary motion that actually might cause a change in consciousness over very long periods of time. It led us to the work of Valerie Hunt at UCLA, as well as, I forget the name of the fellow that's working on transcranial magnetic stimulation. Was that John Joe McFadden?
Yeah, John Joe McFadden at Semi Field Theory.
And there's, you know, a whole fascinating body of work there that indicates magnetic pulses close to the brain can enhance performance.
Yeah, actually, and in some cases even create euphoric experiences.
Right, and I believe that answers the question of how these ancient people were able to locate these sites without scientific instruments. Certain sensitive people in particular can simply feel the effects. Yeah.
Okay, so you're saying then the shaman or holy man of a particular group would sort of pick up on this and say, let's put a, you know, a cairn or a henge or some megalithic structure here to mark it. Is that pretty much what was going on?
Yes, for the shamanic pre-agricultural communities, yes. The more intriguing question, though, is, you know, why did they decide to connect it with seeds and design certain things that could make it work better for seeds? And I think that was a long evolutionary process covering centuries, with trial and error observation. And in the book, we do list several examples of how they could have observed this at work. And one quick one is in Europe, mushrooms, and of course the shamans were the great mushroom hunters. The mushrooms are known to grow much more prolifically along these conductivity discontinuities than elsewhere. So that's just one example of where they could have seen the effect on these energies improving plant growth.
That's interesting. So they could actually just sort of look at the landscape and get an idea that this might be one place where such
case,
an effect
occurs. In other cases, I think they'd feel it just when they got to certain spots.
Great. Well, we're going to have to take another quick short break here, but you are listening to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Krutner with Jeff Pitino and our guest today, John Burke, author of Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty.
We'll be right back.
If you are interested in the topics discussed on today's show, you'll want to see Walter Crittenden's award-winning film, The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones. Why do civilizations fall and rise again? What did the ancients say about the cycle of the ages? The Great Year explores the possibility that the rise and fall of human culture might be related to our sun's motion around a companion star. Find out more about the celestial mechanics that bring higher ages of enlightenment and learn where we are today in this grand cycle of time. It's a message of hope and inspiration and answers many questions about the greatest enigmas of human history. Order the DVD today at thegreatyear.com. That's www.thegreatyear.com. www.thegreatyear.com. thegreatyear.com.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Cruttendon is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
In college, I took a lot of history and liberal arts classes, and frankly, I don't remember much of any of it. But as an adult, I find myself engrossed in fascinating programs on the A&E and History Channel. They've pretty much helped me to be pretty impressive at social functions, and I just found out today that I can purchase DVDs of my favorite A&E and History Channel programs right through HealthyLife.net. You should visit HealthyLife.net and order your favorite A&E and History Channel program DVDs as well, and then discover how many people you can impress during your next social occasion.
For all your live or pre-recorded webcasting needs, come to earthchannel.com. Get your web-based message out to a select group or the whole world. It's easy. A pioneer in webcasting, earthchannel.com provides the best products and services to big corporations and government users. And now, this same technology is available to you. They have the best Earthcast encoders, servers, and products to meet your technical needs. But wait, don't want to mess with technical stress? No problem. They'll do it for you. Earthchannel.com is your answer. You can use webcasting for lots of things, like advertising, marketing, customer support, training, and don't forget, web radio and TV. In fact, you're listening to a live Earthcast right now, so come to earthchannel.com. Actualize your audio or video webcasting needs today. You can't beat the friendly service or the price. Call earthchannel.com at 800-849-8978. That's 800-849-8978.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttendon, and we are listening or speaking with our guest today, John Burke, the author of Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty. He's actually the co-author with Kaj Hallberg. John, I've only spoken with you. How'd you hook up with Kaj, and what did he contribute to this body of work?
Well, he's just been a close friend for many years, but he was working with me in England when we first did stumble into these magnetic alignments at Avebury Henge, and worked with me there as well as at Tikal and the Black Hills and some of the other locations. You'll notice he's a professional photographer, and you'll notice most of the photos in the book are his.
Yeah, it's a very good book in that respect. You've got a lot of information, but so many of these sites you want to see, and so you have the pictures there too. That's very helpful.
Thanks.
Yeah. What talk about you mentioned in the book that there's a light phenomenon that you describe at some of the sites.
Yeah, there's some good pictures.
We've heard for years, people talking about these same sites that we were researching, like for example, Serpent Mound in Ohio, and people taking nighttime photographs, seemingly with digital cameras more often, but with both types, usually with a flash, and getting these little glowing balls of light that were hard to place in size, but, you know, they were out there. And, these pop up in lots of places in some photos, but there always seem to be more of them at these type of sites. And so when we went to the Mayan city of Tikal, you know, we deliberately did some experimenting with that and taking periodic photographs on the top of the pyramids while we were conducting these measurements. And what absolutely blew me away when the photos came back from the printer later back in the States was how as the electric charge was at its high, the higher the electric charge, the more of these light bulbs you got. And as the electric charge dropped off in the exact same pyramid, so did the presence of these light bulbs.
And were these normally taken at night, these pictures?
No, during the daytime, but it had to be a flash. So what you're getting, we believe, is a reflection off balls of ionized air, which will, it's a little bit of a complicated explanation in terms of the physics, but essentially air that's ionized can absorb the photo from the flash can absorb the energy, it'll raise it to a higher energy state very briefly, but then quickly those molecules in the air drop back down to their normal state and emit the light back out. Now, that happens all in a fraction of a second, so the human eye can't record it, but the camera can.
And there are a couple pictures here where there are just hundreds of these little circles.
That was on top of the Lost World Pyramid at Tikal, where we got the highest electrical readings in the air that we've ever gotten anywhere, because all these ground charges are attracting opposite charge from the air. So you've got both the ground charge involved and the opposite charges from the air concentrating at the top of the pyramid. And that's where you get these light balls. And, yeah, you're right, there were just absolutely hundreds of them. Until 2 hours after that photo, you'll see in the same spot, there's almost none, and the electric charge is gone. So it's, I don't think it's a coincidence.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, I noticed there was a photo here where it's not a ball, but it's a streak.
Yeah, we see those from time to time also. They're not as common, but it's not that rare either.
And any idea what that means?
No. We believe it's likely to be the same type of air, and as to why it takes a different shape, I really don't know.
Maybe it's like a downdraft or something.
Yeah, or something pulling along. Sometimes it looks like it's a very fast-moving object, but I think it's more likely to be. If you look at it's plasma that we're talking about, the electrified air, and plasma is also what makes up 90-some percent of the universe. And when you look at big clouds of plasma in the in space, they very often have a filamentary structure, and you know those things might be filaments, if you will, at these low energy plasmas on the Earth.
Okay, I guess you know it's modern archaeologists' belief that a lot of these old sites are tombs or used for ceremonial purposes. And the essence of your work is saying that there's other very industrious reasons for these sites. Is that a good way to sum it up?
Yes, it is. Really, we're not saying they were not ceremonial sites, just simply that they could have been dual use. And at least one major expert on Native American religion says the chief purpose of those religions was to help the crops grow better. So it doesn't mean that there wasn't ceremony taking place at these, but I think it explains why people were willing to invest such staggering investment of hours and resources in sometimes. I like the analogy of current day. Probably the biggest structures that man builds today are hydroelectric dams, and they're staggering in their size and how long it takes and how much investment it takes. And we're willing to do that because we know it's going to be worth it in very physical terms, that we're going to get back from it electricity, which is the lifeblood of an industrial civilization. And in these cases, I believe the people were willing to do this because they knew they were going to get back fertility, which is the lifeblood of an agricultural civilization.
I hear you. By the way, I do take issue with a couple of little points in the book. One, I think you had... it often said that, you know, the people seemed to be starving or the soil was very poor until they built this site. You know, I don't know what evidence there is for that, but my thinking is that it could just as well be that, you know, that they have this knowledge, they want to build the site so it can... it can hold more people, it can be more productive, that sort of thing. Not necessarily that starvation is driving them to do
I did not mean to give the impression that there was starvation in a population or famine so much as declining food production at a time of increasing population. So there was just this constant, there was an ever-growing pressure on increasing yield somehow.
Right. Just as we need more energy right now in the world.
Yes, good example, yes.
Hopefully we can get it in ways that are a little less environmentally obtrusive.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. But John, thank you very much for being on the show. It's really been great talking to you.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And once again, John Burke is the author of Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty. You can find it on Amazon.com. I highly recommend it. It's a fascinating book.
And we want to remind everyone out there that our conference, the Conference on Procession and Ancient Knowledge, is going to take place in October 13th to 15th at the University of California, Irvine. John will be a speaker there, along with
Graham Hancock, John Major Jenkins,
John Anthony West, and many, many other speakers. So please go to cpaconline.com and register if you're interested.
That's cpaconline.com.
And once again, this is Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cruttenden with co-host Jeff Pitino.
Expanding your mind. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cruttenden with co-host Jeff Pitino. And that was John Burke, the author of Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty. Once again, he will be at a conference this fall at UCI, the Conference on Procession and Ancient Knowledge.
Yes, and you can get more information on the conference at CPAC, CPAKonline.com. And if you'd like more information on the show or any of the topics we talk about, please visit our website, www.loststarbook.com.
And if there's any special guests or subjects you'd like us to get on or bring up, please email us. We want to respond and explore this whole topic of ancient civilizations as broadly and deeply as possible. Once again, this is Cosmic Influence, and we look forward to talking with you next time. And in the meantime, bring on the higher ages.